What we're doing in a way is doing something that people have done probably forever. But at least in my life, it kind of began, I suppose concretely began, when I met two men, one called Ernest Butler and one called Tom Olerman, whom you'll find regular reference to in the book, because they were the people who taught me about the Tree of Life. And so I came across them first when I was 15, not in person, but I came across Ernest Butler's book, which was called Apprentice to Magic, when I was 15, as a result of a magazine that used to exist called Exchange and Mart, which I don't think exists anymore. It used to be a place where people would sell cars mainly, but there used to be and bikes. There used to be a section in the back where sort of miscellaneous section, and Thorsten's Publishers, I think, had a little advertisement about books of magic, and so I wrote off to Thorsen's and got this catalogue, Aquarian Press catalogue, and that's interesting. I often tell this story as if Ernest's book was the first one I got, and that's just not true, I realise. I sent off for a book called Astral Gateways by Herbert Brennan, which is still in existence. He's still, and Herbie's very old now, but he's still alive and still publishing things. But it was a book that was really about the practice of the serious practice of the imagination, and Herbie was drawing on ideas both from Western and Eastern tradition, and getting you to get and go, and the book was full of practices where you imagine yourself passing through different gateways, and so it could be an I Ching hexagram, or it could be a Tatvic symbol, or it could be the classic image of there being two pillars and a doorway, and it's very simply, if you ever come across it, you'll see it's a very simply written little book. It's not very profound in some ways, except what was profound in it was the way it took the imagination seriously. And as a child, certainly as a child growing up in the part of Wales and the kind of family I grew up in, imagination was very much to be distrusted. And sort of and not seen as a strength. It was very much something that could take you away from the serious business of earning a living. And it was complicated in my house. So my father was a devout atheist. My mother was a devout Christian. And so religious issues were always quite tricky in my home environment. And I suppose I managed by writing off for occult books to alienate both of my parents simultaneously, really, which was probably very sad. It's probably very satisfying when you're 15 to be able to do that. You know, so I mean, God, yes, I remember much later on, really. For the first time I went to see my teacher, Tom, amid my father giving me a lift down to the station while berating me all the way from Clydach to Swansea, not very far, 5 miles, and berated me onto the platform as I got onto the train to go and see Tom. Why are you going to see those lunatics? I remember it very well. But I suppose that there's obviously one level is quite satisfying when you're 15 to upset your parents. But there was also something very strong driving me in that direction. And of course, I didn't know what it was, other than I was looking for something and sort of and the having absorbed Herbie's book, I then got hold of Ernest Butler's Apprentice to Magic. And it's sort of, it's just interesting how things turn on a coin sometimes, because I was trying to weigh up whether to buy Bill's book on Bill Gray's book on Inner Traditions of Magic, or Ernest Butler's Apprentice to Magic. And Ernest's book was £1 cheaper, which is a hell of a lot then. And I thought, oh, I'll go for the cheaper one, then maybe I'll get the more expensive one later. But it's just interesting, obviously, because as a result of getting, I mean, Ernest's book was actually exactly what I needed. I think Bill's book at that time would have been a bit too advanced for me, too complex. What Ernest's book did was give a series of exercises, including principally the middle pillar exercises, which I'm still working with all these years later. And the effect of the middle pillar was very much to connect up myself, to balance myself, and gave me the sense there was something real here, something that I could, by doing these exercises, breathing exercises and visualization exercises, actually, and working with my creative imagination, this had a tangible effect upon me. So, of course, I write to Ernest Kerr, his publisher, and then discover that he's got an occult group that he runs. And I get in touch with him, and there's a whole debate, because I'm 18 at this point, and in those days, they would only let people in if they were 21. So I had to kind of argue my way in, and they were nice to me, and they decided to let me in. And as a result of which, I met Tom Olliman, my personal teacher. Now, Tom was, very, obviously, very experienced Kabbalist, very experienced teacher, but very simple in his approach. In the book, I've talked a lot about his approach as almost like a form of Zen Kabbalah, where he reduced it to its simplest elements all the time. In a way, the place where the book ends, actually, is looking how Tom almost reduced the entire Kabbalistic tradition to the contemplation of two cards. One being the card the Lovers in the Tarot, and the other being the card the Devil. And I suppose what I saw in Tom Olliman was somebody who had lived the Kabbalah. Very quietly, he's hardly known. Very few people even know this man exists. He's not, these days, the whole world, there's so many occult teachers and the world knows them. But Tom, and it's true of Ernest as well, really, although Ernest is better known because he wrote books, Tom didn't write books. The purity and the simplicity of Tom's work and his ability to integrate it and live the truth of his work really was very profound. And I, of course, didn't understand any of that at that point. I wanted to be a magician. I wanted magic. I wanted excitement. I wanted to go chasing demons and beating them up. And, I wanted a bit of a, I wanted an exciting life. Because at that age, you don't realise at that age you will encounter plenty of demons in life. You don't have to go chasing demons. They come to you in all kinds of shapes and forms. And
They're not the glamorous ones.
No, well, they're not. Well, demons, actually, when you really look at demons, they never are quite glamorous, really. They're kind of nasty and icky and but also sometimes very seductive, of course. So, in writing the book that you've all got, I've had to, in a sense, go over all this again, really remember, okay, why? What's this about? Why am I here doing this? Why have I taught this for so many years in so many different places? And somewhere it's about the fact that it connects me to something real. It's like an odd thing to say, but there's something of the substance of the tree, the substance of this tradition, that isn't tidy. It's not a tidy tradition, right? You know, so you know, if I think of some of the Eastern traditions that are very clear, they have very clear paths and very clear lineages, and the Kabbalah is absolutely ramshackle. You know, it's sort of handed on from this person to the next person to the next person, and it picks up all kinds of different nuances. You know, the version of the Kabbalah that I picked up and I got from Tom and Ernest is very connected to what we might also call the British mysteries, or to do with Welshness. It's a mongrel thing, but it has that hybrid mongrel vigour. And it's a tradition that has travelled with the development of Western European civilization. It starts off, of course, in the Middle East, and actually my own particular, as I've said it in the book, my particular belief is that the roots of it can be found in ancient Egypt. But it, in its form as we know it, it appears around about the 11th, 12th century in Europe. And it's a fusion of different traditions, of Greek traditions, of Middle Eastern traditions, and the thinking of the Renaissance. But the intention of it, the purpose of it, is to enable us to connect to something bigger than ourselves, and to do that in a way that enables us to remain balanced and grounded as we walk through powerful material inside ourselves and inside the world. Now, as we're looking at it in this group and in this process, we're looking at two things. We're looking at the structure of the Tree of Life, which we will be looking at, which we are looking at in detail. And then we're also looking at the story of Arthur. That again is another thing that has travelled for hundreds and hundreds of years in Britain and in Western Europe. Story that keeps on retelling itself, just indeed as the tree keeps on reinventing itself. So I encounter all this in 1970, really. That's when I was 15. And it's a time of great idealism, a great explosion. It's after the Summer of Love. There's lots of excitement about the way the world is going to be, and it was an extraordinary time to be a teenager in some ways. You know, the world, you know, particularly teenager living in a small Welsh, very narrow-minded village, Craigevon Park. And So into that world, all kinds of exotic ideas. This dull post-war narrow world suddenly colour erupts, ideas erupt, new things emerge. And it's, you know, how is it that I end up studying the tree, that this is very obscure tradition? There are lots of other things around at that time. But it is about affinity. It's about feeling drawn to something. I declared myself a Buddhist before. About when I was 14, I think. I decided to be a Buddhist at 14, because I'd read a good book on Buddhism in Swansea Library. I'd bought a massive chain with a huge Buddha on it. I think I was pissing my mother off, in particular at that point. But that, and Buddhism is woven in and out of my life, actually, oddly, in all kinds of ways. But it isn't that stuck with me. Could have, but it didn't. Because I was drawn to something that was both rooted in the Middle East and rooted just here. And it's sort of odd, really, in my life I've ended up, you know, most of my work has been here, but the most significant other place I've worked in my life has been Jerusalem. So oddly, that sense of having an affinity to something that is both rooted here and rooted in Israel has been very literal in my life. And what you have in the book really represents my tree, my exploration, my particular set of affinities. They're not yours, you know, there will be some commonalities between us, because we're all here looking at this, we've all been drawn to look at it in some way for some reason. Your own trees will be different from mine. They will have some similarities, but they will be very particularly your own. But I guess one of the things I do want to say about all this is that the work profoundly involves us working on our own psychology, but it is not ultimately psychological. It is real, in the sense of we're engaging with the real world and real beings that do talk back to you. Remember when I used to go and stay with Tom really, really, really regularly. And, you know, I was full of it in those days. And I was, you know, 18, 19, knew everything. Knew nothing, but knew everything. And I was very into Jung then and so on. So I was very comfortable with the idea that all this is psychological. You know, it's sort of, I wanted it not to be as well, but actually really I thought of it as psychological inside my head. And having breakfast with Tom one day, and he said he seemed very happy. He said, "You seem very happy. My uncle brought my dog to see me this morning," he said, "when I was meditating. My dog Blackie. His dog had died. And so what he was telling me was his dead uncle had brought his dead dog to say hello to him. And this had cheered him up because he missed both of them. And I vividly remember the shock of that. The simple reality of what he was saying, right? The simple, you know, it wasn't some, I remembered my dog, it's nice to remember them. He absolutely wasn't saying that. He said, my dead uncle, brought my dog Blackie, my dead dog, to see me this morning. It was really nice to see them when I was meditating. And that's a powerful thing, because he's speaking, you feel it, because he's speaking out of his own body. It's in him. He's not trying to exaggerate. He's not wanting approval. He's just saying, this is what happened to me. This is why I'm happy this morning. So it was a real moment of interruption of my worldview. A real challenge to the know-it-all Ian who thought he had it all taped somewhere. And of course I wanted to believe it was real, but didn't believe it was real, of course. So therefore I was very shocked by him saying, my dead uncle and my dead dog have been to visit me today. Isn't that nice? Another moment I remember, which I've written about in the book, really, is some years later, I'm meditating in a little bedsit in Nottingham. That time I'm 23, a trainee psychologist working for the Employment Services Agency. That's a very exciting job. Anyway, I'm meditating. And in those days, I used to use a little, a little statuette of Merlin. Because I was, as now, then I was very into Arthurian tradition, and Merlin is a very particular figure. So I would meditate upon this statue, and then I would have an interior dialogue with the statue. The statue would seem to come to life and would talk to me. But at this point, I'd got to be quite good in meditation. So I had quite a concentrated mind, and I was quite irritated, because instead of the image of Merlin, I kept getting the image of the Egyptian god Anubis, or a man, or rather literally a man with an Anubis mask on. And I thought my mind was wandering, so I kept bringing my mind back to the statue, the image of Merlin, and suddenly this other image kept coming, and I pulled away from it. And then it was as if the Merlin image, in a sense, almost came to life and almost whacked me over the head. I say, actually, pay attention, stop controlling your mind. Somebody is trying to talk to you. And so I sort of, that kind of shocked me out of my desire to control the whole thing. And then, so then I just relaxed. And I've never forgotten this, because what happened then is this presence, somebody just walked into the room. Somebody walked into the room. So this man wearing a jackal headdress, the mask of the god Anubis, walked into my bedsit and sat down with me. And what I most remember was this incredibly loving and gentle, an extraordinary gentleness. I can't even quite find the words to describe it. But this incredible kind of gentleness. And he didn't say anything very profound, really. He just said hello. And said that we would meet regularly. And that we were beginning something. And then after a while, that presence seemed to go away, and I was left with this great sense of peace and balance. But I was quite confused by it, because I was at that point a member of this organization called the Servant of the Light, and our main meditation methods were the Tree of Life and the Arthurian tradition. There was no reference to anything Egyptian at all. And so I duly wrote up, because what I used to do, I used to write up my meditations. And in, those pre-internet days, once a month I'd send my meditations off to Tom, he would read them, he'd send me a letter back giving me advice, and then every few months I'd go and see him, and we'd spend a weekend together. I got a very swift return from this particular month's meditations, and then he then just asked me a lot of questions. He got me to write up the experience in quite a lot of detail. And then when we met up, he was very pleased about the experience I'd had, because the man who presents himself with the mask of Anubis, he said, is one of the principal teachers behind our school. It's an Butler's teacher, and before him was the teacher of Ernest Butler's teacher, a man called Robert King, who was early 20th century occultist who was Ernest Butler's teacher. And what Tom said to me, what Ernest also confirmed, is that the roots of this particular tradition come from ancient Egypt, and one of the principal teaching figures that appears is this man who presents himself as a man wearing the mask of Anubis, the priest with the mask of Anubis. And again, in a certain sense, you know, it was shocking, right? Because actually, again, this is not only it felt very real, but also this was a man who Tom had talked to, Ernest had talked to, and somebody else called Robert King, who I'd never come across, had also talked to. And this figure has come and gone in my life, appearing, disappearing, coming back again. He's been a good friend to me, a good teacher. The particular function of the priesthood of Anubis is to be a guide to those who are lost. I mean, one of the titles of the god is the one who opens the way. And the god Anubis in the Egyptian tradition is very much connected with the practice of mummification. And the practice of mummification, in its deepest sense, is connected with the idea of resurrection, of judgment and resurrection, which is where we come back to the 31st path.
Could you say that bit again?
Yeah, the god Anubis is very much, in Egyptian tradition, is connected to the practice of mummification. And the practice of mummification in Egyptian tradition, in its deepest element, is about the idea of resurrection, of dying but being then rising in an immortal body. A body of light. And of being able, in a sense, to unite that, they would have described it, uniting the east bank and the west bank of the Nile, the land of the living and the land of the dead. Now the whole process, really, of working with the Tree of Life, is an alchemical process, really, of deconstruction, of death and rebirth, of being recreated. And in a certain sense, what the priest who wears the mask of Anubis did, what the opener did in teaching Ernest and Tom and then later me, is to look at the practice of resurrection. which is not an event, but is a sort of a process, a spiraling process of continuing unnecessary death, which is the letting go of old and restrictive beliefs and energetic forms, so that we arise in more fluidly, more luminously, more with greater enriched capacity of awareness. I mean, that is a difficult thing, but it is a safe process. One of the lovely things you find in Egyptian tombs sometimes is you have this image of the dead person. You have the image of Anubis taking the hand of the dead person and conducting them safely into the place of judgment and resurrection, into the place of the weighing of the heart. Now, the place of the weighing of the heart, a great scene you find in Egyptian tradition, where Anubis leads the deceased person into a set of scales, and those scales are weighed. The heart of the person is placed upon one scale, and the feather of truth is placed upon the other scale. And if the heart balances, the dead person is then brought into the presence of Osiris and becomes an Osiris, which is to say, becomes resurrected, becomes luminous. So the heart of Egyptian tradition, the heart of this process of death and resurrection, is the act of balancing, the act of aligning with truth. Now, in the practice of Kabbalah, certainly in the practice of this 31st path, we are encountering this, the encounter really between the Sefer Hod and the Sefer Malchut, and Hod in particular, the place of the mind, that the creative mind that can either promote truth or promote the lie. And the nature of this path is a fiery path that burns away that which obscures. I mean, one of the layers of this path you find in things like martial arts, if you're doing Tai Chi, or one of the harder martial arts, there is one thing I found about my own practice of Tai Chi, it completely shows me where I am. If I'm off balance, my Tai Chi is really off balance. When I'm in the flow, I'm feeling balanced inside, my practice of Tai Chi, reflects that. There's no hiding place in that place where the mind and the body have come together, in that sense of conjunction. And that's one layer of a much deeper principle, of the coming together of embodiment with the creative mind, with the creative intention. And as part of that, as part of this, there's this whole territory we have to look at, and it's the reason I suppose why I'm labouring it so much today, is that we are dealing with something that is real. We're not having conversations in our head. They're partly in our head, but actually more deeply, when we meditate, when we encounter these images, we're communicating with something that is real, that is speaking back. And in some ways, one of the most important attitudes we can have in this is almost that childlike attitude of meeting these things simply. Not getting complicated, not doing complicated loops in our heads about did I make this up or did I not make this up, or actually just, okay, suspend judgment for a moment, but allow yourself to be impacted. Allow these presences that you encounter to talk to you. Talk back to them. Have the conversation. Because if you do that, and if you trust that, you will be led along the way. You may often not feel like you're being led. Most often, in my experience, you know, you often think you're alone in this, and that is a necessary thing in order for to develop independence, to develop confidence, to struggle with whatever obstructions arise in us. But in actual fact, you are never alone. When I look back on the pattern of my life, really, and if I think of myself in Nottingham, sitting there, and this presence, this man walks into my room and tells me that we're going to be friends, and tells me that he's going to teach me, and I'm excited and freaked out and kind of believing it and not believing it, and I tell Tom about it, and he is, you know, because he was always very matter of fact. Tom's method was always to take the heat out of stuff, particularly because I'm Welsh and imaginative, and I can get very carried away. Tom would always cut me down, but be very kind of matter of fact. Oh yeah, you've met him. Good. Oh, that's good. Why did it? But that, then he would tell me, yeah, well, I know him, and then he would explain. You know, this is the teacher behind our school. It was sort of easier in those days, actually, than today, in some ways, because there wasn't much information around. You know, I used to get my books from Helios Book Service, and it was a bit like, in those days, it was a bit like buying porn, because it come in these brown paper envelopes, and, you know, they give nothing away, these envelopes. There was no advertising on it. Anonymous things. It was a completely under the radar thing. And there wasn't internet, there wasn't social media. So there was a way in which information was hard to come by and precious when it came by, and so you focused on it more. And your imagination wasn't... If I think of the Servant of the Light, who my friend Steve now runs, one of the problems that Steve has is that I didn't have, was that image of the man with the mask of Anubis has been talked about very openly, and so a lot of the time people imagine seeing this figure, but they expect to see it, so they see it. I had no expectations. It was very weird for me. And all my sort of symbolism, all the symbolism I was working with was Hebrew or Arthurian. And suddenly this dude with an Egyptian dude turns up who, it doesn't make any sense to me. What the hell is that doing there? That's why I just thought I was doing something random. You know, partly because I've always liked Egypt, you know, and I just thought I was on a little trip. So then to discover that this figure wasn't something in my head, where I had talked to other people, not just people around me now, but people before me, people who were dead, and this was a known thing. That there's something very both shaking and convincing about that.
This is like, you know, when they say a trial has been spoiled because people have been leaking information. Do you feel?
Yeah.
I mean, in a way, it's sort of, we have to worry about whether any of our experiences are tainted by that prior background knowledge, this huge background knowledge. We have all sorts of things.
Yeah, it makes it more difficult. It gives us different challenges, I think, really. That's why I think in some ways, it's harder to get hold of information. It was easier for that information to impact me. I think these days people studying the mysteries who have a harder time because there's so much many ideas around, and it's so easy to get hold of information. I think I think it's harder. I think it's a different set of challenges. But the key thing in the end, actually, despite all that, is that. Because we are dealing with something real, it doesn't really matter if we get lost in fantasy, but there's actually something real underneath that can cut through that. So that's the fundamental, it's okay that the challenges today are a bit different than they were in my day, but nonetheless that reality is still there. So as we sit together, as we talk about these things together, as we practice the meditations, we are gathered together here also, but also other people are gathered, including the man who sometimes wears the mask of Anubis. Well, the real thing has, when you when you meet somebody, and you're not in control of what they say. It's always like that. For example, in the previous course we were on, one of the helpers that came was Paddy Aminope, who turned up, and I wasn't expecting him to. He just did, and. Various of you who did that course have met Paddy Aminope and have some sense of him. What happens when you meet these figures, they persist and they have their own life. They come and go in their own way. You cannot summon them up as if they're just a part of your own mind. They step in, for example. I mean, the reason I'm talking about him now is that he stepped in my actual experience just as I was talking. I wasn't particularly intending to talk about him, but he turned up. He's not literally physically, he's in a different dimension, but he is with us, with me, and I'm part of the things that I'm saying. Course come from me, but also come from him. So part of my reality as I sit with you here and now is here we are sitting together, but also with us is this man whom I have known all my life, and who, for reasons of his own, decided to step in today. So what I'd like you to do right now, if you will, actually just close your eyes for a moment. Breathe in. Breathe out. Breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. You are standing in front of the man who wears the mask of Anubis. Breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. Open your eyes. Close your eyes. Breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. Breathe in, breathe out. He holds up a mirror, look into it. Breathe in, breathe out. Breathe in, breathe out. Open your eyes. Close your eyes. Breathe in, breathe out. Breathe in, breathe out. Breathe in, breathe out. He embraces you. Breathe in, breathe out. Breathe in, breathe out. Open your eyes. What happened?
I saw particularly the huge, the mass. Mm-hmm. The body was not so important, the mass. When he held up the mirror, I just saw the same mask in the face again.
Yeah.
The mask, in a way, slightly prevented the embrace. I was ready for a proper, loving embrace.
Yep.
But he pulled us back too soon.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Somebody else.
Anubis, I think he's wearing a suit, which I wanted to reject, but he was wearing a suit. Quite wild and civilized.
Yeah, nice, yeah, lovely.
And then I lay from my eyes, I found a cross in the carpet, I was just straight at the cross.
Mm.
And I looked in the mirror, I think it was Anubis there, but then it was just flames, and my head was flames.
Okay, really.
And then when I was embraced, I just cried with relief at being there.
Yeah, well, excellent.
Extraordinary relief.
Yeah, I can hear.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Let everything go.
Yeah, lovely, good.
I felt totally disconnected, and it also affects how I'm feeling altogether today. And you keep talking about it being real, and I keep trying to listen to that and hear it and know it, and I'm disconnected. Yeah. But when you said he embraced, I had a sense of something, and when I thought about it afterwards, it brought tears to mind.
Okay, good, good. So that's important. Yeah. So you touched something.
Sorry?
So you touched something in that moment. So your experience was disconnection,
yeah.
Right? Nothing wrong with that. Don't make that wrong, right? So you experienced this. So the first two experiences were of disconnection, yes.
Yeah.
And then touching something. So that's the whole experience.
Yeah.
Don't make any of it wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I saw you with the mask of Anubis on, the mask on, and then I saw you in the mirror, and then you embraced me.
Yeah.
So I don't know, it's like...
It's that connection, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's...
I suppose seeing you as the teacher and channeling that.
Mm. Yeah. And of course you've literally seen me do that in the lodge. So that's part of me, yeah.
That's what came to me.
Oh, came to you, yeah, I think so, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm.
I saw an owl in the mirror regularly.
Mm-hmm. What kind of owl?
Tawny, I think.
Yeah, nice.
I'm struggling to stay present with functional off that top, and I was really with the dog. Mm. It sounded very upset.
I know.
I don't know how those two things are related, but it feels like they might be. I didn't see anything in the first one. Second one, it was almost like a greyhound, but almost like side on and kind of smiling.
Uh-huh.
And then the hug felt quite real.
Good, thanks.
This dog's been accompanying you through your tour.
I know, yeah.
Stop now.
Yeah, so I think somebody's attended to it. I think somebody had left it. I think it was left locked up in a room down there, basically. I think it didn't like being left alone. Somebody's obviously collected it.
So the Anubis is connected to the dog, kind of?
It very much is, yes. Yeah.
In this morning's meditation, I had quite a powerful encounter with a child that was called after. He's been in the news. And I don't really want to go into it because it's very distressing, but it's just one of those terrible cases of a child that's been very badly neglected.
Yeah, I do.
Meditation was a sort of a feeling. Mm-hmm. It was very symbolic. It wasn't just that child. And then at lunchtime, I went to the church to visit Joseph Mathias' stained glass window, as I like to do, and the priest of the Mass Anubis turned up. But there, so it's all been a little bit weird for me. You're talking about him now. Somehow I get this feeling that there's this really, really serious need for healing of areas that have been neglected. And whether that's personal in me or it's collective, I think it's both.
Yeah, very likely, yeah.
So I'm a little bit sort of like, you know, you saying it's real and then it's a bit of a strange coincidence. I'm sort of slightly freaked out.
Okay, well, you're freaked out because you'd encountered the man with the mask of Anubis in the church?
Well, no. I quite often do. He's been around since I was younger, but I often wear the suit, Rob.
What's the freaking out bit about?
Well, that it was not just my... more evidence that it's not my imagination.
Oh, I see, right, okay. Yeah, totally.
Sort of feel a little like...
Yeah. No, I think that's right. I think it's the shock of the view, right? The shock of something not being just in my head, not just part of my own personal psychology. In a way, that's great, but it is quite challenging. I think that's real, yeah.
You're destroying things. You said to sort.
Yes.
I think it's here, yeah.
Yes, you did, actually. Yes, that's right, yeah.
Interesting to me what you're saying there, because my experience this morning linked up with a dream I had earlier this week. So I had a dream where I was in a graveyard and I could hear a baby crying. And the baby was in one of the tombs in the graveyard. And I searched. I woke up. But in the meditation this morning, when we were in the thing, I found the baby. So I kind of. It kind of linked back into this.
Oh yeah, the real
thing. I brought the baby out. The past. There's something.
It's in your card, isn't it?
That's powerful, Malcolm.
I was thinking about the figure of death a couple of months ago. It just came to me as I was falling asleep. Anubis or Mashbar, and then babies in the subsequent room being responsible for the baby. Once I wrote down, and that's what you remember. Something, judgments have been continually reborn.
When you talked about resurrection in the in the pathway, that's the point where I found this baby.
Yeah.
So it does link to that, to the judgment card.
Yeah, very much so, yeah.
I love this idea of resurrection as a process of becoming. That's brilliant. That's a new idea for me. I'm so wedded to the Christian idea, you know, it's all I've known as I've grown up. That's fantastic.
Ali, what about you? What happened to you?
So when you were talking about resurrection, it felt very overwhelming because it was about the resurrection of everything and just the way that it was very tied in with evolution and change and development, and it sort of felt sort of just overwhelming because of that concept that it's resurrection and something else and more complicated and not in as we're taught to conventionally think about resurrection. When I looked in the mirror, Anubis was standing over my right shoulder, and very much like Penny, I almost got to the point of hugging and then you stopped it. So I felt a bit cheated.
Well, you can come back to it.
So I left with the resurrection thing. And yeah. And I wanted to know the person who was walking down the white path today in my station. Was it somebody in particular, or was it
It was Berinthus, who is the ferryman in the Merlin traditions. So he was the person who then steps onto the boat and takes the tiller and kind of.
I did mention his name,
but not at the beginning. It was later on, I think, as it's in the place where he turns to face us. And then, because remember what I do when I do meditations is I am describing what I see. It's not script. So I didn't know who that person was until they turned, and I realised, oh, that's Berinthus. So I literally, all I ever do with these things is I'm describing what's happening to me. So that turned out to be Berinthus, who was the... So first of all, there wasn't anybody, then there was this hooded figure, and then I followed him, and then eventually, just before getting on the boat, he turns around, I realised, oh, it's Berinthus. And, yeah.
Mine's got an eye patch on my Berinthus, I don't know why.
Oh, okay.
So my conscious mind started making all those associations when I got to just had, and he's hurt his eye.
We'll break for a cup of coffee now, I think. But just before we do, of course, the thing that happened, we are all, it's balance, right? So if we take this is real, if we accept that it's real, we also have to accept the place where we distort reality, and this is the nature of this path in particular. This is the conjunction of sovereignty and the mind, and the mind has the capacity to reveal truth or to create the lie, and so a lot of the learning around working with this path is learning to recognize when the mind and the body are coming together in balanced form, or when the mind and body are coming together in unbalanced form. And a lot of the learning around that is just by doing and practice and that being able to get this felt sense of when something feels congruent and balanced and when something feels a bit off?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
I just noticed something recently happening where the little pillar become more important in some ways. So when we did the meditation this morning.
Yep.
And at home too, I've been trying to have the middle pillar with me all the time. So I'm running up and down, if you like. Where am I? So I can't see much anymore. I don't think I see very much anyway, but that sight of mine is gone. And I'm always in the dark, but that's nothing. But I'm constantly wanting to. Am I in the ground? I've quite got a place there I like. And in my hips and my, you know, constantly feeling that and feeling comfortable about it.
Okay.
As though I'm at home in some way. So, like when the journey is like I'm trying to take all of me in that form. So I'm very slow. So I might not see the white stones. I might not be there.
No, that's fine. I mean, if that's what you're needing to do, because it sounds like it sounds like that's very useful for you to do.
Feels at ease.
Okay, good. So then it's about trusting that, isn't it? And then when you're meditating on your own, you have the time. It's always, group meditation is always a bit difficult from that point of view, because often it can be not enough time. But I think there's something about if that's what's happening and if that's yielding good results, just trust that. Trust your own way of this unfolding for you, Andy. Because what that will be doing all the time is embedding that sense of balance, that sense of integrity within your whole system, really.
It's very hard to do it in normal life. I mean,
out here. No, of course, yeah. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, I think that's right. I mean, that's in reality, that's what we do. And then we come back to ourselves. You know, we learn we're not in balance by discovering that, and then you come back to yourself and you start to establish balance again. I think that's why it's a continual practice, I think, really. Okay.
I don't really want a break, but I've got a question about the meditation this morning because we didn't really have a chance to talk about that.
Okay, just ask you now.
Shall I do that now? So mainly, all I got was like an angel and this being of light.
Yeah.
Through the whole thing, I wasn't really following the rest very well.
Yeah.
But afterwards I thought, I think it's possibly Raphael. And I kind of did an image as much as I could of what I felt. It's just really a sense of a light, a being of light, an angel of light.
Okay, nice, yeah.
In motion.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And just like all you can see is the light. But I just realised in the judgment card, And is that Raphael or?
Well, sometimes I thought of being Gabrielle, but it doesn't have to be. Just these things can mean all kinds of things. But that does sound like an encounter with Raphael.
Yeah.
Right, Raphael is the angel of Hood, healing angel, oft associated with that killer.
And that felt like it was a real experience of that, because I wasn't expecting it.
Yeah, no, totally, absolutely.
Then the few days prior to that, I feel like I've been connecting with Sandalphon.
Yeah.
I've kind of got an image. I can't really paint it properly, and I don't know whether he's got wings or not, but he's something like that.
Oh, that's a nice image.
So I'm not sure if that's him or not, or whether it's someone else.
So when you look at that image, does it give you the feeling of Sandalphon?
Yeah, it's not quite right,
no,
but
sure.
There's something about it.
Okay, good. I would just trust, because these forms present themselves to us in forms that speak to us, yes? And sometimes, so trust that presentation. If that's the, you know, so the other one has the feeling quality of Raphael, this has the feeling quality of Sandalphon for you.
Yeah.
Okay, so trust that.
And I feel like I can work with the archangels between them.
Yeah, exactly.
So I've been working with that with the other cat.
No, exactly. So that's one of the ways of working with that, and actually something we are going to go on to do really this weekend is to be in the conjoined fields of those archangels.
Yeah, so that's what I was practicing.
We talked about it, didn't we? Yeah, well, good.
There was a question and it's gone. Yeah, because I think I've encountered him before when I just saw these feet and this really tall.
Yeah,
I didn't know it was. And then I read something saying something about Sandalf. I thought, oh yeah, that makes sense. So I sometimes think, oh, did I make that up? But then I think, no, it's kind of confirming.
Yes, yeah, confirming what you've already seen, yes?
Yeah.
Yeah, good.
So it's hard, isn't it, that line? Like,
no, it's always hard, but yeah.
I read that and I'm now seeing it?
Yeah.
Or have I seen that and that's a experience on the inner?
Yeah, and that's always something to look into a little bit, really. But the telling thing at the end is when you've had a real experience, that sort of felt sense is in you somewhere.
Yeah.
You have a sense of an actual encounter, as opposed to something my mind has created.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Okay. Let's have a break for quarter of an hour and have a cup of tea, and then.